Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. By Business Energy Action, challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. By Fairpoint Communications, small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. By Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow, and by the over 1,000 VBSR members. Here's noted Vermont author David Goodman.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. In about an hour, Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin will outline his budget priorities for fiscal 2015 in an address to the Joint House and Senate. The governor is expected to offer his plans for closing a $70 million shortfall in which revenues during the next fiscal year are currently projected to fall short of expected needs for state spending. We're going to spend the hour with a number of advocates a little later in the hour looking at some of the key issues both that the governor will address and that will be coming up in this session. But we're going to start with WDEV's Mark Johnson, who's over at the State House and will soon be hosting the speech from there. Mark, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
David, good afternoon.
So, Mark, I think this is the 15th budget address that you have covered for DEV, and maybe you've covered even more prior to coming here. Do I have that right?
Boy, that's actually new information to me, but I guess that sounds about right.
Well, so you have a unique perspective on these things. So set the scene for us a little bit. What is the significance of this particular address for this or any governor as you've seen them?
Well, I think the key thing this year, David, is that I think that 2014 is really kind of what I would call the in-between year. You've had the past 4 years, the state of Vermont has received just a ton of money from the federal government through the bailout program, the ERA program, the American Recovery Act. That's about $800 million over the past 3.5 years that they've received. So one of the real challenges today is where are they going to come up with money, given that the spigot from the federal government's been turned off, plus no more money coming from FEMA because of Irene. And then on the other end of this bookend is next year, where there's going to be discussion about trying to fund the single-payer plan. So, you know, the governor is somebody who's been adamantly opposed to raising broad-based taxes, but I think even more so this year, there's going to be a push to not raise revenues, to leave them on the table for next year. But, you know, the challenge of how you do that when you've lost all this federal money that came in the past, I think really is what makes 2014 really different.
Any hints about what his ideas are for closing the $70 million hole?
Well, they're pretty tight on information at this point, but my understanding is that the governor, they've sharpened the pencil. They've made some small reductions here and there. They have some money in reserve. So they are projecting that they are going to be able to close the gap. You know, I think really bottom line on this year is it's not going to be a year of, you know, huge, big initiatives because of those financial pressures. One area the governor will continue to talk about is what he talked about last week with the opiate addiction problem. And there's going to be some significant money targeted for that, including what he did mention last week, immediately $200,000 to go into trying to reduce the lines at the treatment centers. Plus, there's going to be discussion about trying to draw down a lot of Medicaid money. Through the Obamacare, there is the ability to draw down money for treatment, which is new. So they're depending in large part on that. There's going to be discussion about Vermont Health Connect, the website challenge. And that's something that the state of Vermont's got to come up with about $10 million bucks in order to continue to finance. I think I would look towards the medical claims area to see funding for that. That story sort of dribbled out last week. So those are really some of the highlights. But it is not going to be the year of the big initiative. It's going to be a year to really just try to hold the line. But spending will continue to go up, which will really irritate some people, I know.
So last week's address has gotten a lot of press nationally. It was a front page mention in the New York Times where the governor, you know, turned over his entire address to a single issue, drug addiction in Vermont. What do you hear in the building as a response to that? That was a kind of a dramatic flourish that he put on this topic. What's been the reaction?
It's been pretty positive, you know, across party lines. I think it's one of these issues, David, that most people can rally behind. You know, I think everybody has now, whether directly or indirectly, whether you know somebody who's been addicted, whether you've been the victim of a crime, you know, this just cuts across all demographics. You know, people were saying last week, and you might get a kick out of this, that this is a really gutsy speech. You know, governors like to talk about really positive stuff, and it's a gamble for him to talk about something negative. I just disagree. I think this is an issue that, you know, just affects everybody from the kingdom down to Bennington. And it's so I think most people responded pretty positively. There were some questions about how to pay for it. There's about, in addition to the money they're hoping to get from Medicaid, there's about a $2 million tab that all of these programs that he talked about last week would eventually cost. So there's a cost issue. So the only grumbling I really heard was, okay, great idea, but how's he going to pay for it?
Right. So as someone who's seen a lot of these addresses, are there any memorable moments or big surprises that come to mind for you from past budget or state of the state addresses, ones that really stand out?
Oh, you mean like the ones where the teleprompter breaks and they have to go to the speech, you know, the paper speech, those kinds of things?
Oh, I don't know. Or what, even what they said. I think that happened to Shumlin's very first address, didn't it?
Yeah, in fact, it did. And he and his group make darn sure that everything's working properly. You know, nothing really, it's, you know, what's, I guess what really strikes me is that just the difference you know, Howard Dean was not somebody, he's a guy who can give a great talk, but always had a challenge giving a speech. Jim Douglas was, you know, a great public speaker, wasn't the most dynamic public speaker, but gave a pretty good speech. Shumlin, you know, still the jury's out on him. He, you know, I thought last week he really missed an opportunity, that this was an issue that really should have had a little bit more passion in it. You know, he had people in the audience who are recovering addicts. He did, you know, he did point them out and honor them. But I just thought he really missed an opportunity to give a speech that had, you know, had some real emotion to it, and he didn't.
And yet, in the how common is it for a governor to take just one issue? Last year, Shumlin did education. This year, drug addiction. Is this kind of a new trademark of Shumlin's, or have other governors gone that route before?
Well, it's mostly more of a laundry list of issues. They usually try to touch on, you know, the environment, financial, just to make sure that they touch all the bases. But, you know, Jim Douglas spent quite a bit of time in one of his budget addresses talking about a scholarship program that he hoped to develop that never came to pass. So there's usually an emphasis somewhere. I mean, education funding was something that he would talk about quite a bit. You know, Howard Dean was always all about money, 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 holding the line. So, yeah, I mean, this is different, but, you know, it's a big issue. So it's one that cuts across the healthcare, law enforcement, corrections. So in a way, talking about what he talked about last week really did bring in a lot of other areas.
Right. Well, last week we had on Governor Dean, and I asked him what he was feeling an hour before he went on for his State of the State, and his response was, I was just trying not to screw up. So
yeah.
I don't know how Shumlin would answer that question, but there's a little insight into what's going on in a governor's mind at this moment.
Well, I loved Howard Dean's answer last week when you asked him if he wanted to run for president. He says the problem with running for the second time is that you know just how hard it is, unlike the first time when you're just naive.
Yeah, he was less cagey and more downbeat in answering that question than we've heard him be in previous months. I was struck by that.
Yeah, I was too.
All right. Well, Mark, thanks so much for previewing what's going to be happening in about 45 minutes when we'll come back to you there at the State House.
All right. Take it easy.
Okay. We're going to turn now to some of the people who have been working on a variety of issues throughout the session. Our first guest is Avram Pat. He is a consultant on energy issues and recently retired as general manager of Washington Electric Co-op and also a board member of VBSR. Avram, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So you have been focused this session on net metering. So let's just start with the Net Metering 101 and explain what it is to our listeners.
Okay. I'm going to make a short disclaimer here because I was asked by Dan Barlow of VBSR to talk about this issue and particularly VBSR's position. I happen to have testified there on my own behalf this morning at the State House. And while I think our positions are consistent or compatible, mine are, really much more specific. And I'm not here representing myself, but more VBSR and where that organization is at on this issue. So with that, net metering, which has been around for quite a few years in a number of different phases, is originally started out as being self-generation, which is a homeowner or a small business might put up solar panels, let's say. That's by far the most common form, and generate all or some of the electricity that they use, and then by doing so, they do two things. One, they are using a renewable source of energy, and two, they are reducing or eliminating the amount of energy they need to buy from their utility because they are connected to the grid. So they're not off-grid. They're connected to the grid, and they are obviously getting power from their utility when the sun is not shining at night, for instance. But they're also generating their own and sometimes putting additional electricity above what they're using onto the grid on a very sunny day, let's say.
Well, in simple terms, people think of this as running the meter backwards, where you essentially bill the electric company for power that you're generating.
Yes, that's how we used to describe it, and two things have changed. We used to talk, first of all, about the meter spinning backwards when utilities had the mechanical meters with the disc that went around, and you could literally see it going the other way. Most people in Vermont now have smart meters of one kind or another, depending on their utility. The other thing that changed in 2011, when the legislature made some significant changes to the net metering program, is that the value of the generation, instead of simply running the meter backwards, there's a monetary value that's associated with the utility's retail rate, the residential rate for most people, and they're actually being credited the dollar amount rather than just seeing it appearing like they're using very little electricity.
Now, currently, utilities have to cap the flow, kind of the reverse flow at 4% of their peak demand. What is the current proposal? What are you?
The current, first of all, what happened during the course of last year, or actually in December of the year before that it started, was a few of the utilities, and these are particularly rural utilities, crossed the cap that is in the current statute, which means that if the amount of installed net metering on their system exceeds 4% of their system peak, the moment in time when they're using, their whole system is using the most electricity, then the utility can should not be taking any more net metering. And that, and what resulted was that customers or members of a few of these utilities, the first being Washington Electric Co-op when I was still the general manager there, crossed that line that's in the law, and ultimately the Public Service Board really ruled that the way the law is written, it's not an option. They really can't take any more net metering. So you have customers of some utilities, sometimes in the same or neighboring towns, who can't net meter if they wanted to put a new project on at their property, and customers of other utilities, including Green Mountain Power, who can. So some problems have arisen that are kind of resulting from some of the way the statute is written, and there's a real concern, some coming from the utilities in terms of some of the economic and rate issues that arise from the way the law is written now, and from the other side, including from some VBSR members who are in the business, we want to encourage a vibrant renewable energy industry in Vermont, and suddenly a number of businesses that are installing these small renewable projects at people's homes and businesses, suddenly the door is slammed for them. So the legislature is trying to come up with both a short-term fix so that people can continue, new people can continue choosing to net meter, and down the road a little ways, 3 years from now, coming sort of redesigning the program to address some of these issues that have come up.
We're talking with Avram Pat, who is the recently retired general manager of Washington Electric Co-op and now an energy consultant and a BBSR board member. And we're talking about the push for to change the net metering regulations. So the Public Service Department...
And I will add that, you know, BBSR has taken a position, and Dan Barlow from BBSR testified very recently in the House committee that's dealing with this, that they would, the VBSR would like to see the Vermont getting to a point where there is no cap, that there really is not any kind of arbitrary limit on how much net metering people can put out there, but at the same time recognizing that some of the revenue type concerns that have been raised by utilities do need to be addressed so that this is not affecting the infrastructure that is in fact needed in order for net metering to succeed. So I just wanted to make sure we got VBSR's position out there.
And the issue is that particularly for some of the smaller utilities, as I understand it, the net metering, the payback that they're getting from the energy companies, electric companies, in fact, goes beyond the provision of electricity, but gets into the cost of, you know, the transmission of electricity and things like that. Is that correct?
I think this is true at every utility, which is when, as I said a few minutes ago, when the value was monetized, the law also changed so that monetized value, a dollar value, went against the bill, not just against the energy part of the bill, but the entire bill. And every utility in the state has what's called a customer charge. It's a fixed amount of money that you pay regardless of how much you use. It's usually the first line item on your bill. And that is to help the utility recover some of their fixed costs, by no means all, but some of it, because they're incurring those costs in serving you whether you ever turn a light bulb on or not. So
kind of like the base rate of a telephone.
Yeah,
it's just the
right
cost of
having
it.
And it's really not so much in my opinion, the fact that these utilities are smaller. It's that they're rural. And so in the kilowatt hours charges that you pay, a much higher percent of every kilowatt hour you pay for is going towards the poles and wires, basically, because let's say Washington Electric Co-op's case is only 8 residential meters per mile. So the impact is there on everyone, but it's being felt much more at the rural utilities, and I think that's regardless. Some of them are very small, and some of them are larger, including Vermont Electric Co-op, the other co-op in Vermont, which is I think now the second largest utility in the state.
Now, the Public Service Department is recommending an increase to raising the cap on net metering from 4% to 15%. By 2017. What is the status of that? Is that what's kind of up for consideration this session?
The Public Service Department's proposal, which they put together after many months of talking with all of the people that have a stake in this, which includes utilities as well as renewable energy industry people and renewable energy advocates, and they put together this proposal that, from what I can tell and from following the testimony of a variety of people who are saying they're on board with this framework. So I think is this going to come out of the legislature at the end of the day exactly the way the department proposed it? I don't know. But that general framework of raising the cap, also making some adjustments in terms of the value or the credit people get, and then asking for a full review of this program so that 3 years from now the program might look very, very different as a result of that study or review.
Well, nevertheless, it's pretty significant. We're talking about a fourfold increase in net metering and the capacity, that
right.
Individuals
and one thing I should point out is that the capacity means when we use that word, when you put up a solar panel and we say capacity, that is the theoretical maximum amount of energy that system can generate at, let's say, at the sunniest day of the year at the peak of sunshine. In reality, the amount of energy that solar produces is a much lower percent. So when a utility hits, let's say, 4% or 10% of their peak load, the way this is measured, the amount of energy they're actually getting from that is the kilowatt hours. That's a smaller amount.
And just pull back the lens a little bit for us here. And
Sure. The
source of this is, explain how much of our power are we getting from solar now, and what's the change from the past?
I don't have the numbers at hand, but the amount has increased fairly dramatically from, I would say, next to nothing to a starting to be a measurable amount really in the last few years. It was publicized over the summer that Vermont has the highest use of solar per capita, ninth highest, I'm sorry, in the country compared to other states, a few states that are ahead like Arizona and places that you might expect. But Vermont is very much in the lead in that. That's coming from a combination of increase in net metering, the small self-generation type that really has jumped in the last few years, as well as some small scale but commercial size projects, which the legislature has also creative incentives for.
Okay, very good. Well, Avram Pat, I want to thank you for filling us in on the state of net metering. Avram, a consultant on energy issues and the recently retired general manager at Washington Electric Co-op. We'll be back in the second half of the show to talk about GMOs and also the state of healthcare for small businesses. So we'll be right back here on the Vermont Conversation.
Looking for a loan for your Vermont business, childcare, or nonprofit organization? Look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund. Because at the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we lend to Vermont businesses and nonprofits, even if the bank says you're not quite ready for a loan. At the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we focus on people, not profits. We'll work closely with you before and after you get your loan to make sure you get what you need to succeed. The Vermont Community Loan Fund makes loans to early stage companies and established businesses ready to take the next step. We lend to farms and food producers, high-tech businesses, manufacturers, retailers, childcare businesses, affordable housing developers, service providers, and other nonprofit organizations. We make loans to Vermonters doing business right here at home and around the world. So if you're looking for financing to help your growing business, look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund. Visit us online at investinvermont.org. That's investinvermont.org.
AP Update. I'm Tim McGuire. Based on the tone of questions by several Supreme Court justices, it seems likely that the High Court will strike down a Massachusetts law setting a 35-foot protest-free zone outside abortion clinics. A number of anti-abortion activists sued the state over the 2007 law, claiming it violates their right to free speech. AP Radio's Ed Donahue has more.
Eleanor McCullen is among the protesters suing to overturn a law in Massachusetts that won't let her get within 35 feet of the entrance to clinics.
Anybody that doesn't want my help, they say no thank you and they keep walking. That's fine.
But Marty Walls at Planned Parenthood of Massachusetts says before the law took effect, other protesters had different approaches.
There were large groups of people standing shoulder to shoulder in our doorway, usually screaming at full volume, not quiet counseling.
Abortion rights supporters say incidents of violence are down in states and cities that have buffer zones. Ed Donahue, Washington.
AP Update, I'm Tim McGuire.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility makes the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman available each Wednesday, along with People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow. Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. Fairpoint Communications, small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. And Business Energy Action, challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. As well as over 1,000 plus VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation, where in just a half an hour we'll be turning over here on WDEV to hear the governor's budget address with Mark Johnson. But in the second half of our show, we're going to look at two issues that are hot on the agenda of the legislative session this year. The first being GMOs, and the second will be healthcare. We'll start with GMOs. Last year, the Vermont House was the first legislative body in the U.S. to approve a bill that would require the labeling of foods derived from genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. But Vermont won't be the first to pass such a bill into law. That happened in Connecticut, where last June, Connecticut's General Assembly approved the first GMO labeling law in the country, and that was enacted into law. We're joined by Chris Miller, the activism manager at Ben & Jerry's, who's been our guest here before in the Vermont Conversation. He's been leading the company's campaign to win mandatory labeling in the U.S. of GMOs. Chris, welcome back to the Vermont Conversation.
Great to be with you, David. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, what is the state of GMO legislation now in Vermont?
Well, as you suggested, the Vermont House passed a bill in the last session that would require mandatory labeling of genetically engineered food sold in grocery stores. And the Senate has taken up the bill, and two Senate committees are dealing with the legislation, the Senate Agriculture Committee and the Judiciary Committee. I know that the Senate Ag Committee has been taking testimony on the bill, and we expect that at some point in the next sort of week or two that the committee will vote on the bill. We're hopeful they'll vote to pass the bill out of committee and move it on to judiciary. So really hopeful that, you know, over the next couple of months, Vermont will be the first state to pass a bill requiring genetically engineered food to be labeled without a trigger, which, as you know, both Connecticut and Maine have included in their legislation.
Explain that notion of a trigger.
So the trigger requires a sort of critical mass of states in the Northeast to pass legislation before either Connecticut or Maine's bill takes effect. So the Connecticut bill, for example, requires four northeastern states, one contiguous to Connecticut and with a combined population of 20 million people, before Connecticut's bill will go into effect.
And what about Maine? Where do they put the trigger?
It's a similar standard, so it too would require four states, and there's a population trigger included in theirs as well.
It's a strange thing to do because you're essentially saying that your state's legislation is contingent on another state's legislature.
That's right. It is an odd way to make policy. I'm not familiar with other states on other kinds of issues adopting a sort of state that requires other states to move before your law comes into effect.
What is the reason for putting that kind of condition on this law?
I think the primary reason is that states are concerned that those who oppose labeling and have spent, both in California and Washington state, tens and tens of millions of dollars to oppose labeling, will frankly sue the state to try and stop the labeling law from coming into effect. So I believe that policymakers are thinking there is perhaps some safety in numbers, and that it would spread the cost of that legal challenge. But it seems to me to be quite a sort of slippery slope and frankly a bad way to make policy. I think those who have looked at the language of the legislation in Connecticut, in Maine, also Vermont, feel that states have the authority to regulate labeling of genetically engineered food. And so, I believe that what opponents are trying to do is frighten legislators into taking this safe position. But I don't think there's any guarantee that a trigger protects a state or the legislation from a legal challenge. I think opponents are going to fight hard on this issue, and that is perhaps one avenue in which they will fight regardless of a trigger.
Why is GMO labeling important to Ben & Jerry's? Why is VBSR pushing it?
Yeah. So for Ben & Jerry's, we sort of led the fight, 10, 12 years ago against the first genetically engineered food product, which was RBGH, the genetically engineered bovine growth hormone that was used on cows. We believe that consumers have a right to know what's in the food they eat, and increasingly consumers are interested in knowing whether or not the food they're buying contains genetically engineered ingredients. I mean, frankly, we're sort of agnostic on the technology, but we believe that companies ought to be proud of what they're selling consumers, and that consumers ultimately ought to have the right to know what's in the stuff they're buying. It's a pretty straightforward concept, and I think polling on this issue is upwards of 90% of Americans supporting this. There are very, very few issues that you find that kind of consensus on. And, the truth is there are 64 other countries around the world that require genetically engineered food to be labeled, from Australia to Brazil to Europe, to Russia. And so we would be joining much of the rest of the world in requiring labeling of genetically engineered food.
So currently, is Ben & Jerry's able to say that there's no genetically modified food in its products?
We can't say that at this time, David. And I'll talk a little bit more about what we are doing, but I also want to be clear that the legislation that's been passed in Connecticut and in Maine and the legislation that's being considered in Vermont would not require food companies to change anything they do, right? This doesn't ban genetically engineered ingredients. All it does is require companies that have ingredients that are genetically engineered to place 5 words on pack that the product may contain genetically engineered ingredients. That's all it does. As you know, there are a whole host of regulatory requirements as it relates to food labeling. You may know that farm-raised salmon requires labeling. It's also true that orange juice made from concentrated orange juice requires labeling. So this legislation doesn't require anyone to change anything they're putting in anything they're selling. All it does do is require transparency around those ingredients. So it's important that that distinction be made. The opponents have suggested that this legislation is going to increase the cost of food. And we have to be clear that we're adding 5 words to a pack, and there just is absolutely no evidence or reason to believe that a minor change in a food packaging label has absolutely any impact on the costs that shoppers pay for food in grocery stores. So let me then come to your point around what Ben & Jerry's is doing. We have made the decision to transition out of genetically engineered ingredients in our products, and we will be making a claim on our label that we're doing that. That conversion is ongoing. I think we currently have 14 flavors that we're selling that contain no genetically engineered ingredients and are making that claim on pack. And I think we will complete that conversion by mid-year. So all by about sort of mid-June or so, all of the flavors we'll be producing will all be made without genetically engineered ingredients.
What's wrong with genetically engineered ingredients?
I don't know that there is... there is no evidence. Well, we don't have a point of view on whether or not genetically engineered ingredients are good or bad for people. I think we made the decision because we have a 35-year history of really supporting small-scale family farming. You know, we source all of our dairy products that we use in our ice cream from the family farmers of the St. Albans Dairy Cooperative. We strive to support small-scale, smallholder family farming. And we think that's a better way to farm than, you know, large commercial agribusiness operations. And we believe that the system that has been built up around, you know, specifically genetically engineered commodities like corn, soy, and canola really play to the strengths of a sort of commercialized agribusiness. And so we chose to do it not because we think that there's anything wrong with using a genetically engineered ingredient in our ice cream, but we worry about the impacts of the further industrialization of agriculture. And that's why we made the decision to do this.
Well, finally, Chris Miller, what are the prospects of getting it through the Vermont Senate so that GMO labeling becomes law in Vermont?
I think we're incredibly optimistic. The Vermont Right to Know Coalition is planning a large citizen lobby day tomorrow, Thursday, at the State House. We'll begin with the rally on the State House steps at 1 o'clock. As you know, VPIRG collected over 30,000 signatures in their canvas this summer. Vermonters in every city and town across the state supporting genetically engineered labeling. And this is an incredibly popular bill. I think legislators, senators will be hearing from constituents and businesses like ours around why we think this is not just good for consumers, but actually good for the Vermont brand and good for Vermont business. And I'm hopeful that the Senate will do what the House did, and that's to pass a bill and move it on to the governor's desk for a signature.
Okay. Well, Chris Miller, thanks very much for joining us again here on the Vermont Conversation.
Thanks as always, David.
Chris is the activism manager at Ben & Jerry's and been leading the company's campaign to win mandatory labeling of GMO foods in the U.S. In Vermont. Our final guest before we go to the Statehouse and Mark Johnson is Bram Kleppner. Bram Kleppner is CEO of Danforth Pewter in Middlebury and co-chair of Vermont's Medicaid and Health Benefits Exchange Advisory Board and a member of the Governor's Business Advisory Board on healthcare financing. Bram, thanks for joining us today on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you for having me.
So bring us up to date. Today we learned that there's a new delay for small business to sign up for on the healthcare exchange. Bring us up to date. The news changes daily, and it's confusing to try and catch up with the state of where we are in terms of getting health care in Vermont.
Sure. So you're right. They this morning or yesterday morning made an announcement about another delay. And where things stand for small businesses is that those small business who chose to offer insurance to their employees in 2014 started the year with the plan and expectation that the only way to buy insurance as a small business was through the online exchange. It became clear in December that the technical back end of the website would not be ready for small businesses to successfully do that. So small businesses were given a couple of options. The insurers in Vermont, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and MVP primarily, very graciously offered to let every small business in Vermont simply extend their existing coverage for 3 months at the same price, same coverage, no changes. Another option that small businesses had was to call Blue Cross or MVP and to buy directly from Blue Cross or MVP the insurance coverage that would have been available on the exchange. So you could move to one of the new exchange insurance coverages, or you could stay with your old one. What's new now is that small businesses who choose to offer insurance will all end up buying directly from the insurance companies one of the new products, because the 3 month extension through which companies could simply stay on their old insurance is expiring and won't be extended beyond that. So small businesses now are going to call the carriers, they're going to directly enroll with the carriers in one of the products that will become available on the exchange. And the folks working on the exchange are going to keep working on it until it's fully functional and running smoothly, and then small businesses will transition onto the exchange website.
So tell us, what is working with the healthcare exchange? What's going right? We often hear about the things that are, you know, broken, but what's the big picture here?
So, you know, Vermont's exchange is where individuals and small businesses will buy insurance, and the individuals part of it is now working. Tens of thousands of Vermonters have signed up for insurance through the exchange as individuals and as families who are not covered by their employers or do not have other access to insurance. And of those, the vast majority have received reduced costs. They've received federal subsidies. I think 80% or something like that of the people who've signed up have received reduced premiums. And of those, in fact, maybe it's higher than that, and of those, 80% also got reductions on their out-of-pocket. So there's a large group of Vermonters who have access to affordable health insurance, perhaps for the first time in their lives. That piece is working. They've signed up. They're getting bills for their insurance. They're paying their bills. The bills are getting processed. It's not working perfectly smoothly or perfectly quickly, but it is working. You know, in that vein, I would say that you know, our company, Danforth Pewter, did successfully sign up our company and our employees through the website prior to the announcement in December that we would need to be extending our current insurance. So, and again, the sign-up process was not easy and it was not quick, and I certainly understand that the problems with the website were hurdles that were too high for some people. You know, I certainly understand people who got into it and there were problems and they said, you know, this doesn't work, forget about it. But with a bit of persistence and a number of calls to the help center, we were able to successfully execute that first step. So, you know, I'm fairly optimistic that that process will get easier. It works. I know there's a team at the Department of Vermont Health Access who are working night and day and to make the process smoother and easier and more intuitive and to debug the bugs that have prevented businesses and, in some cases, individuals from successfully completing the process.
So what have you found at Danforth Pewter as you help your employees sign up through the Vermont Health Connect? What are you finding in terms of savings or not that they're able to get through this through the Vermont Health Connect?
So the subsidies, the reduced cost premiums, the reduced premiums are not available to businesses. So these are only available to individuals who are buying as individuals. So, you know, that piece of it is not available to Danforth. What we have found is that we found sort of the most similar insurance coverage that's available on the exchange to what we had been offering previously was a tiny bit less expensive for the company and for employees than our previous insurance, you know, a few dollars a month. However, that is a huge win in the world of healthcare, where we're used to double-digit increases every year. To have it stay flat or even go down, even by a tiny amount, is a win. Another thing we found as we helped our employees sign up is that the call center was pretty helpful. And, you know, we did this process early enough so there wasn't a huge volume of calls. So our calls were answered pretty promptly and our problems were taken care of. Subsequently, as the call volume went up, the wait times got to be pretty long and people were frustrated. I understand the call center is adding another 30 people this week and, you know, they're addressing that problem. But we were early enough, so we sort of made the calls before that problem arose. The call center was helpful. When there was a question the call center people could not answer, they elevated it to the Department of Vermont Health Access staff, who did provide us with answers as we worked through that. And the last thing we found is that for our employees, in spite of all the help and support we gave them, the process was somewhat scary. And the majority of them, when confronted with various options, the majority said, look, I don't understand how insurance works. I don't understand all of this. Just sign me up for whatever's closest to our current plan, because, you know, I understand what I have now and how much it costs and what it covers. And so sign me up for that. So, you know, I think there's an education piece on our part and on the part of the state so that people are more comfortable taking advantage of the range of choices that will become available to them on the website when that's running.
We're talking with Bram Kleppner, the CEO of Danforth Pewter, who's also co-chair of Vermont's Medicaid and Health Benefits Exchange Advisory Board and a member of the Governor's Business Advisory Board on Healthcare Financing. Are the plans that you're signing up for through the Vermont Health Connect basically the same as what you had before, or how do they differ?
So we did, when we signed up on the exchange initially, we did offer, as the Obamacare law requires, our employees a range of options. And the biggest difference among the options are what are called the metal levels, bronze, silver, gold, and platinum. And the difference among those is really the insurance coverage is the same. The bronze plans have lower premiums and higher deductibles and out-of-pocket costs. The higher plans, gold and platinum, have higher premiums and lower out-of-pocket costs. So, you know, the coverage is actually slightly better than it was previously. The Obamacare law mandated that the coverage include things like children's dental is now covered, which wasn't necessarily the case before. So coverage is slightly better. As I said, cost of a silver level plan for our employees is slightly lower than the cost of the plans we had in the past. And, you know, that choice of lower premium, higher deductible versus higher premium, lower deductible is pretty meaningful in a company where you have a broad range of people, from those who never ever go to the doctor, for whom it makes sense to pay the lowest premium because they really don't have much in the way of out-of-pocket and they don't have prescription drugs and so forth, to people who have chronic conditions and have a number of prescriptions and know they're going to max out their deductible. You know, a higher level gold or platinum plan makes sense for them. They end up doing better with those. So it's a meaningful set of choices that employees have.
So, Bram Kleppner, as a member of the Governor's Business Advisory Board on healthcare financing, as you look into the future, what do you expect or hope that single payer will mean for your company, Danforth Pewter?
The thing that I'm most looking forward to is our getting out of health insurance administration business. You know, we design and make and sell pretty things. We don't know anything about healthcare administration except that we've been reluctantly forced to learn. And, you know, the fact that Americans get their health insurance through their employers is really an unintended consequence of policies from decades and decades ago, and we've sort of gotten used to it. But, you know, I really think Vermont businesses will be much better off when we don't have to spend any time at all on health insurance, and that remains something that employees get directly from the statewide program.
As the governor will momentarily be delivering his budget address, and one of the big questions hanging over it is, how are we going to pay for single payer? As a business owner here in Vermont, what concerns do you have about that?
The original report that Dr. Hsiao gave to the legislature years ago that they commissioned on what Vermont should do with its health care system, the original report that recommended we move towards single payer, recommended financing the entire system with a payroll tax. And it recommended, I think they calculated it was an 11 or 12% payroll tax to pay for the thing. I think in our own case, our health care costs all in have actually been above that. They've sometimes been 14 or 15%.
Okay, Bram, we're actually going to have to leave it there and cut over shortly to the State House. But thanks very much for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation. And
you're
that'll do it
welcome.
This week for the Vermont Conversation. We'll be over to the State House shortly with Mark Johnson.
You have been listening to the Vermont Conversation with host David Goodman. Tune in next Wednesday when, once again, Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and its over 1,000 VBSR members, along with Fairpoint Communications, small business owners make it big with Fairpoint, National Life Insurance for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow, People's United Bank, find out what know-how can do, and Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to patient, community, and medicine since 1879, as well as Business Energy Action, challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. These all help to bring you David Goodman with this special program.
Locally owned and operated, 96.1 WDEV FM in Warren, FM 96.5 in Barrie, and AM 550 WDEV Waterbury, Montpelier.
I'm Tim McGuire, the Senate Intelligence Committee.